This is the Breaker.News podcast for July 22nd, 2018. Welcome, I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines about the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines about the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature. With 12 weeks to go until Civic Election Day in Vancouver, I sit down with research co-pollster Mario Canseco to talk about his latest findings about the candidates and the issues. And I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or should we never forget these British Columbians? Chris Mohan, retail store worker, 22. Ed Schellenberg, repairman, 55. Ping Shun Ao, retiree, gardener, 74. Alfred Wong, student, 15. Paul Bennett, nurse, hockey coach, 47. These are six of the innocent British Columbians who have been killed in the ongoing gang war. They were going about their lives when all of a sudden, through no fault of their own, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some of those responsible for Mohan and Schellenberg's murders in Surrey in 2007 have been brought to justice, but in 2018, the case is still not closed. British Columbia's justice system works too slowly. Some say we don't even have a justice system, but it's actually a legal system. The killers of Ao and Wong have not been found. The Integrated Homicide Investigation Team said this week that Bennett was the victim of mistaken identity when he was gunned down in his Cloverdale driveway. Police say they want to find anyone who knows about a four-door silver Honda Civic that was near the scene of the crime on June 23rd. A letter from Bennett's family says the nurse and hockey coach, Paul Bennett, spent his life helping others. Now please help Paul and our family find the closure we need to move forward. Call your local police if you have a tip. But also call your local politician. Write a letter. Send an email. Especially your mayor and the candidates for the October 20th municipal elections. The recent report to the NDP government by Peter German made the link between organized crime in Canada and the Pacific Rim, the real estate industry in Metro Vancouver, and money laundering at our casinos. It is all connected. But those we pay to keep our communities safe are not doing enough to keep our communities safe, if innocent citizens must live in fear. What do you think? Email me, bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Orange Wang reports, remote Chinese city hopes to board the Hyperloop Express after signing deal with U.S. firm to try to build 1,200 km per hour rail line. A crowdsourced U.S. venture, which is pursuing the dream of a super-fast underground railway, has signed a deal with a remote Chinese city to develop a test track there in a deal that may help advance Chinese ambitions of becoming a world leader in the sector. Hyperloop Transportation Technologies, which is trying to turn the Hyperloop concept into reality, said that it would team up with Tongren in the southern province of Guizhou to build a new 10-kilometer test track for the high-speed transport system that it claims could reach a speed of 1,220 kilometers per hour, or 760 miles per hour. The California-based enterprise is one of several ventures trying to develop a new type of transport system propelling capsules through vacuum-sealed tunnels, a concept popularized by Elon Musk, the Tesla boss. In the Los Angeles Times, Neil Leiterg reports, the Brady Bunch house is for sale. Its broker expects an avalanche, of lookers at least. Here's the story of a lovely family home, which just hit the market in Studio City for $1.885 million. The Brady Bunch house, a traditional-style residence near Colfax Meadows neighborhood, was used for outdoor representations of the beloved television family's abode. That included the show's opening and closing scenes, as well as numerous interludes to denote the time of day. Interior scenes for the Brady Bunch were filmed in studio. The series ran from September 1969 to March 1974, before moving into reruns in syndication. Ernie Carswell, a Douglas Elliman agent who is listing the property, said the split-level house has been updated and upgraded, but retains almost the exact interior decor from the era, though the layout does not resemble the TV show home. In the Straits Times, Ng Wen reports, Singapore ratifies Asia-Pacific trade deal for market of 500 million people. Singapore has ratified the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, becoming the third nation to do so after Mexico and Japan. The Ministry of Trade and Industry said in a statement on July 19th that the CPTPP is a high-quality agreement that will reduce market barriers as well as foster trade in a combined market of 500 million people with a gross domestic product of $10 trillion. The historic trade deal establishes rules in new areas such as e-commerce and will enter into force 60 days after 6 of the 11 signatories ratify the agreement. Mexico was the first to ratify the agreement in April, with Japan following suit on July 6th. The remaining countries in the bloc are Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Malaysia, New Zealand, Peru, and Vietnam. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Everett Herald, Jerry Cornfield reports, news, media, and lawmakers to resume clash over public records. A task force will begin meeting next month to sort out political obstacles and legal hurdles to getting lawmakers to disclose their records to the public. What's envisioned is a conversation on lawmakers' concerns with releasing emails, texts, investigative reports, and other materials, and the media's demand they do so, like other elected officials, in accordance with the State Public Records Act. Without public hearings last year, the Senate and House passed a bill to disclose such items as calendars, lobbyist emails, and final dispositions of disciplinary proceedings, but it would have exempted emails exchanged between lawmakers and constituents. The action prompted an outcry from media outlets and spurred several thousand residents to urge Governor Jay Inslee to veto the bill. He did, but only after getting majority Democrats to agree to a task force and leaders of the media coalition to participate. On Coin 6, Oregon's Colin O'Brady, 50 peaks, 21 days. When Oregon native Colin O'Brady reached the summit of Mount Hood, it was the finale to an exhilarating 21-day stretch of climbing the tallest peak in all 50 states. That's right, he climbed the tallest peak in every state in 21 days. He walked, ran, hiked, and climbed more than 300 trail miles during the quest. He crisscrossed the country and traveled 13,000 miles. In the last week, he climbed 150 miles across 8 peaks, and each peak was at least 11,000 feet. In the Narwhal, Sarah Cox reports, Site C Dam Secrecy Extraordinary, International Hydro Construction Expert Tells Court Proceeding. An international hydro dam construction expert describes the high level of confidentiality surrounding BC's Site C Hydro project as extraordinary, and says he has never encountered such secrecy during his 5 decades designing, developing, and managing large hydroelectric projects, including China's Three Gorges Dam. Quote, I have never seen in 50 years a major public project or program being put in place for its ratepayers by a public agency providing as little information. Harvey Elwin, a civil engineer who has held major leadership roles with large multinationals working on hydroelectric projects around the world, states in an affidavit filed in BC Supreme Court. The 14-page affidavit forms part of Elwin's expert testimony for an injunction application by a Treaty 8 First Nation to halt work on the over-budget Site C project, pending a full civil trial that aims to terminate dam construction on the grounds that the project infringes on treaty rights. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Countdown to Election Day in the city of Vancouver is down to 12 weeks. Vancouverites, on October 20th, will choose a new mayor to succeed Vision Vancouver's Gregor Robertson. This week, the Vancouver and District Labour Council endorsed independent Kennedy Stewart, the Burnaby NDP MP. And Cope's Patrick Condon has dropped out of the race for health reasons. Pollster Mario Canseco of Research Co. has a new poll after surveying 400 Vancouverites from July 13th to 16th. I sat down with Mario to analyze the latest in the race for Vancouver City Hall.
Even though the level of undecideds has dropped from 47% last month to 35% this month, we still have a lot of confusion. The number one candidate continues to be, I don't know. So that's good news for everybody who is running. I don't think it'll lead necessarily to two candidates dropping out within the next 4 or 5 weeks. I think everybody believes that they can get to that 27-28% level and win the election. But it definitely shows a little bit of a split. Wai Young, for instance, is now at a higher level than she was a month ago, partly because of the actions that she's taken and her discussions about the bike lane. You know, it might be a bit of a hokey campaign, but at least she's putting some policies out there that people are responding to. So she's now ahead of Hector Bremner, for instance. But we do see Ken Sim getting most of the votes that went to Kirkland Point the last time. And to me, that's crucial for Ian Campbell. He needs to get his retention rate, that is, the people who voted for Gregor Robertson in the last election to vote for him, at around the 60 or 70% mark if he wants to have a chance. Right now, he's at 37%. 34% of those votes are going to Kennedy Stewart. So if we continue to have that split in the Gregor Robertson vote from the last election, we're going to see two candidates from the center-left going neck and neck with each other, maybe 3 or 4 points difference like the one we see now, and that could actually facilitate a victory for Ken Sim.
It's interesting because Ken Sim, since he was nominated, he won the nomination by the NPA start of June. They did have one fundraiser. The media wasn't invited in, but he has not been out there pounding the pavement, shaking a lot of hands, knocking a lot of doors that we know of. Kennedy Stewart has been involved in outreach. Ian Campbell's been involved in outreach. That's kind of a strange situation, especially when there's such little time left before this election. And the rules have changed, so you can't just buy a lot of ads. You can't just do a lot of fundraising and buy a lot of ads. You've got to go out and get the smaller donations and shake more hands and knock on more doors nowadays.
Well, it's definitely something that they need to think about, particularly from the standpoint of Sim. I think now that you have a sole NPA nominee, it's a little bit easier for people to walk around it and say, this is what we want. This is the one candidate we will support. Not a lot of action on the other fronts. I think it'll be difficult for all candidates. But when you have the support of a party like the NPA does, it could be a little bit easier. Now, I think the problem for Vision is essentially a situation where you're not getting all of the support that used to go to the incumbent. And you've got to find a way to do the campaign differently this time around. You don't have a lot of money coming in from other sources. It's not the same campaign that they're used to running, and I think that's going to show, and time is running out. I mean, we still have a lot of undecideds, which is a blessing and a curse. I mean, you do have a lot of people who may say, I'm waiting to see what they say, and I'm waiting to see who I want to support based on policy. But the other issue, and I think it's a big one, is who's going to drop out? You know, maybe I want to vote for this particular center-left or center-right candidate, but if they don't stay on the ballot in October, I may have to go elsewhere.
Yeah, and Shauna Sylvester, the independent who had been tied to Vision Vancouver for so many years, was really the first person to set the dominoes in motion back in the spring, and she's really faded into obscurity. And we also had this week the Vancouver District Labour Council make its recommendations, and for the first time in a long time, they're not recommending a Vision candidate for mayor. It's not Gregor Robertson, it's Ian Campbell this time, of course, but they have opted to put their support and tell union members around Greater Vancouver to vote for Kennedy Stewart.
Well, this definitely bodes well for Kennedy Stewart. I think it's an unexpected development on the part of Vision. I think the fact that the Labour Council endorsed more Vision candidates for council than from other parties sort of looks like an olive branch in a way. You know, we're not saying that everything Vision did was wrong. We're just saying that we would like to see somebody different at the head of the table. But again, I think one of the difficulties in the scenario that we're facing right now is can you sustain that momentum? There's places where you assemble around a team, and I think what we're going to see with Hector Bremner, for instance, is these are my candidates for council and for school board and for parks board. You want to create a team around you, which is kind of the way in which Doug McCallum and Brenda Rossotti did it in the last election in Surrey. It didn't work out very well for either of them. Whereas Kennedy Stewart is essentially saying, it's me, and I'm going to work with whoever council sends us. If it's more center-left people or more center-left-minded people, that'd be fantastic. But they will be ready for that.
I mean, Hector Bremner has, this stock has fallen in this poll. He's someone, when you talk about momentum, when he had his set two with the NPA, when the NPA board decided not to allow him to continue on in its nomination process, he was threatening to start a new party. He has started a new party. The branding has been a bit of a mistake because it's also the name of a, Yes Vancouver is also the name of an organization that raises funds for women trying to get back in the workforce. And here he is, middle of summer, about to announce, or at least give a chance to people to run on his team. He seems to, again, have lost so much momentum with his mistakes along the way, with his controversy along the way. He didn't jump on the bandwagon as soon as perhaps he could have in June. He's basically lost 2 months of campaigning.
Yeah, timing is crucial in this situation. I think there was a moment when Shauna was seen as the front runner in a way, because she was the one who was talking about the possibility of Vision not having a candidate. Once Vision had a candidate, the situation for Shauna changed dramatically, and I think Kennedy Stewart capitalized on a lot of that, particularly because of his stance on the Kinder Morgan pipeline. And even if this is now in the hands of the federal government, if there's a core component of voters in the city of Vancouver who despise this project, they are more likely to go with somebody who was willing to go to jail for it. So I think that's definitely going to play a role. And I think Hector Bremner's difficulties really have a lot to do with the way in which the NPA has organized. I think, you know, when you have a candidate like Ken Sim, who hasn't been around, who hasn't knocked on doors, who hasn't done anything over the past few weeks, who has been on holiday, for instance, at the top, it shows that there's a staying power within the party that is not going to be easy to change. You know, the Hector Bremner people are going to knock on doors where people may be supportive of the NPA, and it's going to take a lot of maneuvering and discussing and policy making to ensure that those people support you because you're no longer an NPA member.
And when you look at the issues, you've asked the questions in a bit of a different way this time, but again, housing tops them all. 82% of people say the housing affordability is worse in Vancouver than elsewhere in Metro Vancouver. 57% of respondents also said that the influence of developers is worse in Vancouver than elsewhere. People seem to say that public safety, public schools, fiscal responsibility about the same in Vancouver as elsewhere. Quality of life better. But the overarching issue, again, housing affordability, the influence of developers.
Developers is a key issue. I mean, I wasn't surprised to see housing at essentially the level where it is, where it's 4 out of 5 people saying, yeah, there's people in other places within Metro Vancouver who are having an easier time. But to have a majority of residents say that the influence of developers is worse here, it definitely suggests that there's people who will not vote for a couple of the candidates who are running. I mean, Ian Campbell has been tied to developers. Whether he believes that that's fair or not, it's not something that is going to matter in the end, because people may make that connection. Similar situation with Hector Bremner. So I think there's definitely a situation here where a core group of residents who vote for either of the major parties, this isn't necessarily tied to one of them, are saying enough is enough. Maybe we don't need somebody who's so cozy with the developers. Now, the campaign regulations have changed, and so has the fundraising, but it still may not be enough to suggest that somebody who has worked in that industry, albeit tangentially, is going to emerge from an election like this one unscathed.
And this is also a campaign where, so far, you're seeing that about 63% of people said they don't have enough information about candidates and parties. And again, it's not like the new rules on campaign financing just came into place yesterday. There's been many months, and there's push has been on for many years, that these candidates aren't yet out there being innovative and trying to spend as little money as possible and trying to find as many people as possible to know who they are. The time is running out. It's
well, we are just 3 months away, I think. If you look at it from the standpoint of other elections, I think what makes this one even more complicated is you no longer have the two-party system that is working for everybody. You have a lot of independent candidates or third-party candidates who are trying to get their name across. I think that definitely is to blame for the high level of undecideds, but also because you no longer have the opportunity to advertise the way you did. And it's really going to come down to door-knocking, to grassroots, to volunteering. We are not going to have the obscene expenditures in the final weeks or days of the campaign to try to paint your opposition as somebody who is not fit to run the city, or to try to paint your candidate as somebody who is the best option. It's going to be an interesting experiment. You know, this is the first big election that we're going to have after the guidelines for campaign financing have changed. But in the end, you know, you only have about 12 weeks to go. It's going to be tough to try to figure this out. And also, if we continue to have so many candidates, the debates are going to be particularly difficult to follow. I don't want to imagine a situation where you have six or seven people answering a question about a specific policy. I mean, we might be there all night.
That was my interview with Mario Canseco, a research co at the Tap Shack by Cole Harbour. You can see the methodology and full results of his latest survey. Go to researchco.ca. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the British Columbia Wildfire Service. More than 100 wildfires are burning around BC. There are major ones near Kelowna and Prince George. Thousands of residents are facing evacuation and the damage or loss of their homes. We can only pray that the 2018 fire season pales in comparison to 2017. But for now, we salute the men and the women who are putting their lives on the line to fight the fires and save BC's forests, the creatures that live in those forests, and the people who live around them. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for July 22nd, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on July 22nd in 1969, the All-Star Game was rained out for the first time? The Midsummer Classic at RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C. was postponed for a day, but that meant President Richard Nixon could not throw out the first pitch, because he was on standby for the Apollo 11 astronauts to return from the moon. When the game was played, the National League won the 40th All-Star Game 9-3. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.